Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Well, welcome, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners. My name is Rob Farley, and today I have with me Ben Jones, who is currently a graduate student at the University of Kentucky in the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce. But in a past life, Ben was a correspondent who covered Alabama football. And we today are going to talk about what the future looks like, especially the very near future, in terms of college football. And we may range a little bit into other sports. This is something that has come up a lot in comment threads, but it's also been a situation of much larger concern for sports fans and for higher education more generally. So to start off with, Ben, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. So I'm a little bit warm. Went for a run this morning. It was about 85 degrees outside, but didn't melt, so.
Yeah, I think we are looking at 90s for a wall of 90s running from here until through next week.
Yeah.
So it's going to be warm in Kentucky. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of your history with college football and what you've done in the past?
Right. So as Dr. Farley mentioned, I'm one of his students at the Patterson School here at the University of Kentucky. I got here in fall of 2019. I graduated from the University of Kentucky with my bachelor's in May of 2011 with a journalism degree when I was studying to be a sports writer. So I spent 2 years after I'd graduated from UK covering the Kentucky football team for a website, and then moved on and covered Florida State football for about 18 months for another website. And then from 2015 through summer 2019, so 4 years, covered the University of Alabama for the Tuscaloosa News and also worked on a website that newspaper owned before I decided that maybe newspapers weren't the best bet for someone in his late 20s to try and build a career around.
Right. And so now you're back here. Mm-hmm. You're with us. But you still know a thing or two about college football. So why don't we start off by saying, I mean, what is going on right now in terms of preparations for having this season in the context of a pandemic? So what do we know now about what people are trying to do?
Right. We should probably put the disclaimer at the start of this that most of what we're talking about, I'm assuming, will be pertaining to what is considered major college football, which is to say the FBS, previously Division I, football, bowl, subdivision football, and really mainly even a smaller segment of that, meaning the major programs, the economics of this, and the way that programs like Alabama or Oklahoma or Clemson or Kentucky, that those programs work is very different than a program like what Western Kentucky or, you know, San Diego State or some of these smaller colleges do, even within the same division. And that's to say nothing of FCS or Division II or Division III, really a whole different conversation as you get to different levels of the sport. There will be some similarities, obviously the logistics of having a whole roster of football players and coaches that you have to bring together and prepare for a season is going to be similar. But overall, I think the primary difference when we're talking about major college football compared with other major college athletics and smaller division football is just the scale of it and the economics of it as well. So I can try and break that down into two ways. The scale of the enterprise is significant. FBS football teams have 85 scholarship players. You can carry 105 players on your official roster, plus a few walk-ons on top of that, which aren't allowed to officially join the team until school starts. So, you know, your average major college football team is going to be somewhere in the range of 110 to 120 players that would be available for practice on any given day. Some of those are going to be injured, some of them will be sick, some of them might be at home with personal issues for whatever reason, but that's a decent number. You know, you're in the 110 to 120 range, plus about 15 full-time coaches. You know, you have a head coach, you have 10 assistant coaches, you have 4 graduate assistants, then you have a medical staff, you have managers that are all out there. Really, if you're talking about holding just a standard practice with players and what you would consider essential personnel, I think you'd have a tough time keeping it much below about 200 people out
right.
there.
And so that's the amount of people that you essentially would need who would effectively be unable to social distance in any sort of useful way on a day. Right. So this gathering is much larger than sort of what we're conventionally allowing right now. And this is just for practice, right?
Yeah.
This is like getting players to the state where It's like literally safe for them to play football.
Right. And this is significant, particularly in the context of universities, because when you're talking about a football practice with perhaps 200 people there, you also have to consider that you have officials at a football practice as well and other personnel who are connected with the team doing some other job or whatever. One, there's going to be actual physical contact, which you would not have in any kind of a classroom setting where there might be 200 people. Two, you know, my presumption, and, you know, I don't know if we've gotten any official guidance on this from the University of Kentucky or other universities, but my guess is that there are going to be very few classes where there will actually be 200 students meeting at one time in the coming fall semester at most of these universities. Most of those larger lecture halls, it seems like, will probably be empty or severely distanced and cut down to maybe 100 people where there would normally be 300 people crammed in there. Or transferred to Zoom or some other teleconferencing or asynchronous kind of platform. So football will kind of be unique because you just can't do this in any other way. You can cut down on what you would need to have a football practice and maybe get it to 150 or 160. I don't know effectively what the difference is between having 200 people and 160. Certainly 160 is better than 200, but you know you can only cut it down so much essentially.
Right. And so and let's reiterate here, we're only talking about one team doing its practice, right? If we then project ahead to two teams playing one another, even in an empty stadium, and then, as you mentioned, the officials and everybody else, we're talking upwards of 400 people, at least 500 people who are going to be together. And some of these can be mask wearing people, but still there's not any sort of useful distance between them.
Right. You might be able to, you know, depending on how close to the bone you wanted to cut it, get it down to 300 people if you wanted to limit roster sizes. You know, I don't know if it's necessary in a game to have 100 players there, whereas in practice when you have to play against yourself, it's a little bit different. You would obviously not need two sets of officials for a game. You would only need one set of officials. And if you really wanted to say, you know, only the home team is using its medical personnel in a game, something like that would probably be technically feasible. I don't think any of the programs would be happy about that. They would probably push back on a restriction like that. But I think 300 to 400 for a game without any fans is probably a good number to be looking at. Now, the other concern here when we talk about scale is the economic side of this thing, and that is that college football is really what makes college athletics run at most of these major universities. College football and then men's college basketball are the only sports that consistently turn a profit, even at the highest level of college athletics. You can find, this is for some of the folks who might be listening who are more familiar with college athletics, you can find college baseball programs that actually turn a little bit of a profit. You can find some women's college basketball programs that turn a little bit of a profit. But for the vast majority of major college athletics, football is what makes the engine go. Even here at the University of Kentucky with a very successful, very tradition-rich college basketball program, the actual budget of the athletic department, there's more money coming in from football than there is from basketball because of TV revenue and things like that.
So I have a question on that. What is, I mean, for a sort of power conference football team, right? So we're thinking SEC, Big Ten, Pac-12, and so forth. What is the balance between ticket sales, paraphernalia sales, and TV money, like sort of just in very general terms?
So it will vary, obviously, from conference to conference. The way that this works is that each conference negotiates its own TV rights deal, and then each conference determines how it's going to break up its TV revenue. Generally, TV revenue will be the number one source of income. It is for the Big Ten and for the SEC, which are have the highest income generally of any of these college athletics. I believe that's also the case for the ACC and the Big 12. The Pac-12 is a little bit funky. Their TV deal isn't quite as good as some of the other ones. You know, their TV viewership isn't quite at the level that some of those other conferences are at. And I also just have less experience working with the Pac-12 since most of my experience has been in the Southeast. But it is interesting. You could do a whole nother podcast about this because even 10 or 12 years ago when I was a student, the model was still based on ticket sales and TV revenue. And TV revenue was going way, way up. And it's gotten to the point now where TV revenue has surpassed ticket sales. Ticket sales is still a significant portion of the pie. And I would assume that losing a portion of ticket sales is going to hurt some of these college athletic programs. But TV revenue is really where it's at. And that's probably what's driving this whole thing. Because if you don't have the games, you can't put the games on TV. You can't have the money coming in from that. And then the whole college athletics machine kind of breaks down at some point. All the smaller sports can't go without this, which is why football is important. It might be easier to have a tennis team get together and play than it would be to have a college football team get together and play. But if you don't have the money coming in from college football, then none of the other stuff really works.
Now, an additional question on this point, right? So the University of Kentucky is a really big institution. Ohio State's a really big institution, right? Mm-hmm. University of Oregon, mine, really big institution, right? So you could theoretically, these are large institutions with sort of sufficient reserves and a sufficient connection with the state that you could envision them going for a year without football, without putting really like a tremendous crater. I mean, it puts a crater, but it doesn't snuff out the other athletic programs. Even among the big 50, are there programs that would sort of really be in danger? Their entire sports apparatus would sort of be in danger if they don't go ahead and do football?
In terms of the entire athletic department shutting down, no, I don't think that would be feasible. You have seen cases already of certain athletic programs shutting down baseball teams or rowing teams or, you know, other kind of smaller college sports teams. And in a few cases, I don't think you've seen any FBS football programs shut down, but you've seen some smaller schools shut down their football programs.
Morehouse, right, Morehouse.
Yeah, yeah, places like that. Some of which might have something to do with the pandemic. I'm sure that didn't help cases, but I would guess that several of those programs were probably kind of on the endangered species list already, and this is just what snuffed them out. I don't think there were any programs out there that were healthy that all of a sudden are going away right now just because of this.
So we have here a sense then of why college presidents, why athletic programs, why TV networks want to have this happen, right? That, mm-hmm. that right, even in this context, that they want to have this kind of, we want to have college football in the fall. How to phrase this exactly? How much time do major college football programs need to get their players into safe shape for playing? Right, there are lots of restrictions mm-hmm. on, obviously, on spring practices and then summer practices and so forth. But you know, we have the situation where for a long time players are essentially getting in shape on their own, mm-hmm. and these are not professionals. Right, who can maybe perhaps be relied upon a little bit more. I mean, you know, college football players are serious, but they're also often 18 or 19 years mm-hmm. old, right?
And in a lot of cases, they don't have the resources that many of these professional athletes would. You know, if you're a professional athlete who's making six or seven figures a year, you would hope that you could go out and buy some gym equipment. For some of these college athletes who are on scholarship money, you know, when your neighborhood gym closes and you can't go to your university gym, you're just kind of out of luck at that point.
Right. So how much time do you need to get a football team into shape?
That's been one of the interesting points of contention kind of as all this gets started. So when things started to be shut down was more or less in the middle of March, right? And most college football programs were either in the middle of their spring practice at that point or getting ready to start their spring practice. Spring practice where you have 15 days where you're allowed practice. All of these days are very strictly set out by the NCAA and the amount of time per day and the total days and the amount of days you can scrimmage and how many days can be a regular practice. All of those are kind of laid out in the NCAA rulebook. So some schools were almost done with their spring practice. If they just happened to start in February, they might have been through 12 practices when they had to cancel the last of them in March. And they'll obviously be a little bit better off than some of the schools that maybe had three practices or were just getting ready to start when all of this happened. There have been coaches who have tossed out some numbers. You know, some of them say a normal fall camp before you would start your season is 4 weeks. And some coaches say that, you know, to really make up for the time that you haven't had players conditioning during the summer and the time that you lost during spring practice, they say 8 weeks would be ideal. You know, maybe have a week or two that's just conditioning, that is just making sure that your players can get through practice, that they're in shape, that they can go through all of this safely. A lot of them have said 6 weeks is probably the smallest number that they could feel good about. But in some cases, you may end up seeing something more like 4 weeks of actual practice, depending on what the conditions laid out are. There might be more time than that for conditioning before you go into the 4 weeks of practice. But 4 weeks probably would be the minimum of actual prep time that looks like actual football practice and not just conditioning and weightlifting before you go into the season that I think coaches would feel good about. And that will obviously affect different players differently. You know, if you are a freshman who was set to enroll early at a school in January so that you could learn the playbook during spring practice, well, now you've lost spring practice. And, you know, if you didn't have all that time around your coaches to learn the plays – then you're going to be further behind than you would be just because you've lost days of practice there. If you are an offensive lineman or a defensive lineman who really needs to be lifting weights to maintain your body, then you're probably going to be worse off than if you're a wide receiver or a cornerback who can, you know, afford to slack a little bit more and is maybe a little bit more focused on running and conditioning during some of this time off.
So how is this going to affect? So say that we end up having football in, you know, who knows, October, right? Mm-hmm. How is it going to affect sort of the way the game is played and sort of our visual appreciation of it, right? I wonder this in a couple of ways, right? I mean, you know, okay, both teams are a little bit less conditioned and in shape. You know, in the end, it's not going to be that big of a deal, yeah. Right? We're just going to be watching football. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is this going to be a situation, do you think, where there is going to be a rich get richer, poor get poorer situation based on sort of how sophisticated practice facilities are in some of the programs? Is there enough variation even among the big college programs where you're going to be able to tell, like, look, these people have a great practice facility and mm-hmm. so forth. They've been able to work their team into shape in the way that this other team hasn't. And to add a little bit more of that, are there going to be differences regionally where, you know, the weather in one place is in August is something you can actually go outside and do stuff in versus it's really quite difficult to practice in some of the worst heat in the summer in other parts of the country?
Yeah, I would say I don't have a strict number on this. Most major college football programs at this point have an indoor practice facility as well. Because the NCAA puts down such strict limits on when you can practice and how many days and how much time there is, coaches are very fearful of losing any of that time just due to bad weather, whether that's heat, whether that's if you're in Florida in the summer and you just have a thunderstorm at 3:00 every afternoon. Kentucky has had an indoor practice facility for a couple of decades at this point. We could go to some high schools in Texas or some places that would have indoor practice facilities. That's just kind of part of the culture of it now. There are some schools, and I think it's probably fairly normal, that are moving their weight rooms outdoors, essentially. They don't like the idea of having several groups of players coming in and out of the weight room, even if those are smaller groups than what they would normally be, sweating and breathing heavily onto some of these surfaces, and trying to do conditioning one group after another, and they just think that it's safer to do some of that stuff outside. Certainly it would be easier to move your weight room to a large indoor practice facility, essentially onto an indoor football field, which is just a big open space, than it would be to move it out onto one of your practice fields where maybe if you get that 3:00 thunderstorm, then you have all this iron sitting out there in the rain. That would probably not be a good thing. There probably will be some cases of the rich getting richer in some ways, but this is really pretty speculative on our part because we've never seen anything like this before. There are some situations I can imagine where perhaps a program like an Alabama or an Ohio State or an Oklahoma can afford to test players literally every single day or close to every single day, like what you're seeing with the NBA as it restarts in Orlando. Some of those smaller schools are presumably just not going to be able to afford that. You know, a school like a Western Kentucky or at that kind of a level on the kind of the bottom half of the FBS level of competition. And that could really vary pretty significantly. You know, maybe they can test them once a week. Maybe they're only testing players who are symptomatic or who have come into contact with other players. I think that's all going to have to be worked out kind of individually at the level of the school. And there probably won't be uniformity in that. So there could be a pretty significant difference. The other difference where I could see the rich getting richer a little bit as you get into the season would be what happens if a guy tests positive. Because presumably if a player tests positive, he's going to be out, you know. I would assume that the conferences will have to agree on some sort of a rule where a player will have to have two consecutive negative tests before he can come back or will have to sit out for 14 days from the time of his positive test, something like that, which will actually affect competition. You know, it's not difficult at all to conceive of a scenario where the starting quarterback of a team that's contending for the national championship tests positive, and all of a sudden he's going to be gone for 14 days. He's going to miss two games. That's a really significant loss. You know, that's not any different than losing your best player due to injury, and perhaps any player that he comes into contact with. So there, if you have some of these the rich get richer scenario, the bigger schools that have invested more heavily in recruiting and just tend to have better players, you would assume that their number two quarterback will be much better than the number two quarterback at a smaller school. That's usually how it works.
Right. I mean, sort of the general reduction in scholarship numbers has prevented some of those bigger programs from sort of bankrolling depth in the same way that they used to be able to.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, we could easily see mid-season forfeits, right? I mean, and we'll get to this in a second, right? If some substantial number of players on a team are in contact with one another and turn up positive, I mean, how many players, at what point are teams just going to have to forfeit games if they don't have, I mean, obviously it's more than 12, right? But where are you going to have to start forfeiting games if you have too many players positive?
I don't know. We were talking right before we started recording that Clemson at this point has had 37 players test positive, I believe. That number might be a little bit higher now. That was a few days ago when I saw that. That doesn't mean they have 37 players positive now. That means they've had 37 players since they got back to campus test positive. And certainly if you had 37 out of 105 players who were positive on your team at one time, I don't know that you could put together a roster that you would feel good about playing, especially if you start factoring in things like if there are going to be rules about, you know, players who've come into contact with these 37 players have to sit out for a few days or something along those lines. Then you're not just looking at 37, but maybe you're looking at 50 or 60. And again, that's very speculative. Not all of those 37 players tested positive at once. I would presume that some of them tested positive more than 2 weeks ago and are back at this point or on their way back. But you can imagine a scenario where five or six players on a team are out in 1 week because they've tested positive. And then the next week, those five or six are still out. And then 12 more are out. And now you're at 18 plus whoever maybe has come into contact with those 18. And you can start to get really messy really quickly.
And now there is some precedent for rescheduling in terms of, you know, really horrific weather events and so forth, right? So, I mean, people must be thinking through, mm-hmm. okay, well, I mean, this will be a question, right? So you have, and I don't, I mean, I'm just sort of coming up with this, right? So the Oregon-Ohio State game, which I've certainly been looking forward to, is one of the earliest games in the schedule. Let's say that, 12 Oregon players and 16 Ohio State players test positive beforehand. Mm-hmm. There would have to be some consideration. It's like, well, do we treat one of these as a forfeit, or do we try to reschedule this extremely important, very lucrative game between two really important teams and move it to a place that's much farther back in the schedule?
Yeah, that would be really, really difficult just for the logistics of everything involved, and certainly for anyone who might have a ticket to that game. I don't know that, I mean, I think we can say pretty safely that these stadiums will not be at 100% this fall. They might be at some level of fans who are allowed to come, whether that's just friends and family, whether that's friends, family, and students, whether that's friends, family, students, the people in the luxury boxes, whether that's 50% total. I don't know what it will end up being. I would guess that there will be some level of fans at the games this fall, one way or another. And when you start moving games, then all of a sudden that really messes with that ticket revenue that we were talking about. There's also just a factor of, you know, if decisions are being made at the conference level and not at an NCAA level, then there will not be uniformity in some of these regulations from conference to conference. Alabama is set to open its season this year, I believe, against Southern California in Dallas. And while the SEC and the Big Ten, which is the Southeast and the Midwestern schools, have really pushed hard for a relatively normal fall football season, you've seen some of the Pac-12 schools talk a little bit more, or maybe float the idea a little bit more seriously, of pushing everything back until spring. With most of these non-conference games, there's a contract that's written up for them. I've read some of these contracts because of Freedom of Information Act requests, and there is a clause in pretty much all of them that says in the event of war or hurricane or some other act of God, I don't think pandemics were ever explicitly mentioned as one of those possible causes, though they might have been. It's obviously been more than a year since I've read any of these contracts as part of my work. But I think that this would certainly be one of the extenuating circumstances that would allow for some of these games to be canceled. Now, at that point, you know, there's probably lawyers being involved, because the guarantees for these games are anywhere between $3 and $7 million. I would guess that Oregon-Ohio State game is probably at least a $5 million game. But that's just a guess off the top of my head. So there's big business that's involved in this. And, you know, once you get the lawyers involved and once you have decision makers that are higher than just the level of the schools, it could get pretty messy pretty quickly.
Now, because you brought up Southern Cal, I mean, there is one interesting point here where a lot of the Pac-12 schools, and I don't know, I honestly don't know how common this is across the country, but a lot of the Pac-12 schools use a quarter system rather than a semester system.
Okay.
And so at least the first three or four games, it has always been the case that the football team is there before the students, because they start playing a month early,
right.
which resolves maybe some problems that come up, but not all of them. But Southern Cal announced that it's not going to have in-person classes at all in fall, right? So you have this sort of odd situation in which the football team is going to be literally the only people who gather on campus in any sort of substantial group before 2021. And we can talk maybe a little bit more about sort of what that tells us in term long term in terms of how we think about the student athlete, right? And the student athlete as, you know, as an amateur versus the student athlete as a professional. So what is the state of the art right now about what's going to happen? Like, what are the proposals, right, that are floating around right now? And I guess also to step back a little bit about the fans in the stands. I watched a Korean baseball game yesterday. And Korea, in South Korea, the pandemic has effectively been quashed, and yet the stands are still empty.
Right.
So we would be talking about having fans in the stands while the pandemic is still raging in the United States, when other countries are adopting much more restrictive measures. So what are the plans right now that are out there that are extant?
I think that they're kind of still up in the air. You do hear about some games being canceled. I believe the Naval Academy canceled one of its games just the other day. Obviously, I'm not tuned into the college football world as acutely as I was about a year or two ago. But I think it's kind of being constructed on an ad hoc basis. A school like Alabama, which I think is, I haven't spoken with anyone in Alabama, so don't take this as Ben Jones, former Alabama beat reporter, talking about Alabama's schedule. I think there's probably some level of concern with Alabama that this game against Southern Cal might be canceled. And they're probably out there trying to find kind of a backup. I think that there will probably be some other programs which had early season games scheduled against Pac-12 opponents, which will also be kind of left out in the cold if that game doesn't go forward. And so maybe they will end up being able to play against each other. Just off the top of my head, I think TCU had a game scheduled against a Pac-12 school, but I'm not entirely sure about that. So if instead of Alabama playing USC, Alabama plays TCU early in the year in Dallas, that, you know, that's feasible. TCU is right there in Fort Worth. You could almost make that happen, be rather serendipitous. But there are still issues that come with that. You know, if USC was going to be a top 10 program this year and TCU was not going to be a top 25 program this year, then just from a competitive standpoint, that's not as good of a game for Alabama as what Southern Cal would have been. Alabama being a school that's pursuing national championships, its resume, the difficulty of its schedule matters at the end of the year. You know, there's a committee of human beings who sit together and decide what four teams are going to make the college football playoff, and they'll be tasked with trying to sort through all of this stuff at the end of the season, whenever the end of the season gets here, if that's in November or if that's in December. You know, they'll have to sit down and say, well, yes, they lost this game, but their quarterback and their number one wide receiver were both out with coronavirus, and they were undefeated when both of those players were back. You know, this team had to forfeit that game, but there's no way they would have lost that game. You know, this team was supposed to play a tougher schedule, but, you know, this game got canceled because of that. All of that could end up being really difficult once you get to the end of the season.
So I want to talk just a touch about sort of the pipeline in and the pipeline out of college football. One of the reasons that I read that there was some skepticism about shifting football to spring, which would seem to be, you know, now that the XFL is dead, you know, the first time I read it seemed, well, that's a fabulous idea. People have been trying to have spring football for a long time. Why not just move Alabama to spring? The NFL hates the idea, right? Just absolutely hates the idea, apparently, of moving because it interferes with the draft and whatsoever. And my feeling would be, you know, tell the NFL to go pound sand, right? Who cares? But how is any of this going to affect, and you also mentioned high school football in Texas earlier, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are going to be a lot of places where there's no high school football, right, this fall, right? I would expect there are going to be a lot of places. And I haven't been paying any attention at all to, like, whether, to what school districts are thinking about this. But mm-hmm. but there's going to be a lot less high school football. That's going to make recruiting a lot more complicated, right?
Yeah. You know, there will be obviously second and third order effects of all of this, which will probably be felt for years and years to come. Whether that's something like, you know, if the Pac-12 just ends up canceling this season, you mentioned the NFL. How does the NFL evaluate those players that were going to play their junior or senior years of college football in the Pac-12 against the players in the SEC and the ACC and the Big 12 and the Big 10 who did play this fall, if a scenario like that comes to pass? If you cancel high school football, how does that affect recruiting and scouting? I can remember, I'm not going to name any names here or even mention the school. I can remember one player that I covered who was a very highly ranked offensive line prospect who was going to the school that I covered. And apparently his high school coaches had told the college coaches he needs to be an early enrollee. He needs to graduate in December, and you need to get him on campus in January, because if he finishes his high school football season in November, December, and you don't get him on campus until June, in that 6 months, he will gain 50 pounds, and it will take you a year and a half to get his body back, which is exactly what happened. Ended up being a starter for the college team, but took a year and a half before he looked like he could play college football after he got to campus. And you could see something like that happening. You could see the development of high school players or college players being a little bit stunted by some of this. The NFL in the last 10 or 20 years has really made concerted moves to kind of own the calendar year round, where they push the draft back so that there's not a gap there in March and April when there's no NFL news happening. And I don't know how that will end up working as well. You know, if the NFL ends up having its regular schedule this season, then there will be a point in about October when the NFL will be in the middle of its regular season going up against postseason baseball, which it normally does in October, and the NFL normally crushes postseason baseball in ratings, and also against the NBA Finals, which are set to go from August. The playoffs will go from August through October. And in that sense, you know, the NFL might come out on top of that. people really like football, and you will probably see really high ratings for the NFL compared even with the NBA Finals and that kind of situation.
But the NFL is also more vulnerable, right? I mean, at least in sort of the frameworks that we have right now. I mean, baseball and certainly, and especially basketball, have come up with sort of ways mm-hmm. that make sense for right. how they're going to do this without everybody getting sick.
Right.
And the NFL, not quite yet.
Yeah, but again, logistically, it's a lot easier for you to do something like that with basketball, where you have a roster of 13 right. players and four or five coaches, than it is for football, where you have a roster of 120 and 15 coaches. If we were talking about the bare minimum of maybe 300 people there for a football game with no one in the stands, I think the bare minimum for a basketball game would probably be 50 to 60.
Great.
And back in the university context, I would guess that there will be classes of 50 or 60 at many universities this fall. They might be held in auditoriums that would normally be for 100 or 200 people, but you will probably have some classes of 50 or 60 that are being held at universities because they've figured out a way to make that work. So kind of different challenges for football than you would have for basketball or for baseball.
Right. So just to finish up here, what do you think is, like, I'm not going to call it a drop dead date, but when do you think we're going to have any degree of certitude about the first games of this year's college football season?
I would be surprised if there wasn't some kind of certainty by the end of the first week of August or so. At that point, you're within a month of when the season would be set to start, and you need to be making decisions about, you know, are you starting your training camp at this point? Are you starting to put pads on and do actual football activities and not just conditioning? Once you get past that date, then you're probably looking at pushing the season back at least a little bit. Maybe you're just pushing it back until the end of September instead of the beginning of September. But if you're looking at a normal training camp of about 4 weeks, which is what it seems like they're moving towards by bringing back some of these players now during summer for conditioning, then I think you would probably have to see some sense of normalcy or some moves towards starting the season in September by early August or so.
So we've and you having lived in Alabama, you've undoubtedly heard of maybe this maybe apocryphal story of COVID-19 parties in Alabama where you know, people are trying to get sick.
Let me just take a quick diversion here before we get further into that, because the Twitter sphere, which you and I are both probably waist deep in most days, was quick to laugh at the silly people in Alabama who are 49th in education or whatever it is for making dumb decisions like this. The University of Alabama at this point is 59% out of state. So before you want to blame silly people in Alabama for all of this, there's a lot of silly people from Massachusetts and New Jersey in Alabama that were probably party to some of those decisions.
All right. Well, let's talk about this in terms. So Clemson has now had 37 players, over a third of its roster, test positive, right? That number may go up, but that may produce a situation that by October, the Clemson Tigers are relatively immune to COVID-19, mm-hmm. right? They're immune to the depredations of it, whereas other teams are still really vulnerable. What kind of thinking has there been? Is there anybody who's sort of whispering, well, maybe the football team gets it now rather than later, right?
I've certainly seen some of that discussed, again, on the Twitter sphere or on Reddit and in circles like that. And, particularly for a program like Clemson, which is going to be competing for a national championship, which has a quarterback who will presumably be the first pick in the draft, that doesn't even seem that outlandish. It would be a little bit strange if a program like Kentucky had that many of its players test positive at this point in the year. Kentucky just having a little bit less at stake maybe in this coming season, although being competitive and winning games is important to every college football program out there. The reasons to push back on that are many. The first one is we're still not totally sure that you can't catch this again, right? There's no certainty out there that once you've had this once, that means that it will stop you from catching it again. So there may not even be an advantage to catching it at this point. The other thing to remember is that there are many people who have caught COVID-19 who weeks, not just their 14 days later, but 4, 6, 8 weeks, even a few months later, still don't quite feel 100%. All the way back in the middle of March, when a lot of this really started to pick up steam, I remember being at the gym, of course, when the NBA started canceling its games because a player named Rudy Gobert for the Utah Jazz had tested positive, and then one of his teammates tested positive as well. So they canceled the Jazz game that night, and then they canceled all the games the next day, and then the NCAA basketball tournament was started. The NBA now is bringing players together to restart its season, and Rudy Gobert has been on record saying that he still doesn't quite feel 100%. And this is a healthy guy in his 20s who's a professional athlete. He said that something like his sense of smell had only just come back in the last couple of weeks. You and I, since my world now is more international security and intelligence based, we've seen that the military is not sure whether it should accept recruits who have caught COVID-19, even if they are no longer sick, no longer testing positive, because they're not sure of the lingering effects. There are folks who might have decreased lung capacity. That doesn't mean that will be the case a month from now. Maybe they will lift that restriction a month from now, 6 months from now. But there's still a lot that they don't know about it. So the idea of everyone catching it now and then you'll all be fine by October, in at first glance, I think sounds like it makes a lot of sense. But kind of just a cursory examination reveals some issues with that idea.
Right. You don't want to start a college football season by doing something that might significantly reduce the cardio capacity of, a substantial portion of your team. Mm-hmm. So to relate this then to one other thing that's going on right now, what sort of interaction, what sort of interrelation are you seeing between what's going on in college athletics right now, college football, but also college basketball and elsewhere, mm-hmm. and what, for the lack of a better name, are the sort of widespread Black Lives Matter activism, Black Lives Matter protests that are going on right now, which have already had some manifestation in the way that college athletics are being played, right? We've seen a top recruit go to Howard. We've seen issues in Mississippi with the flag. So what sort of interactions there are you seeing?
I think you've seen generally some more moves towards player empowerment. specifically in the context of COVID-19. I believe it was UCLA before the players went back to campus. A group of players said that they didn't feel comfortable going back and starting practice under the coaching staff because they weren't sure that the coaching staff...
We can say the name of the coaching staff here. It's Chip Kelly. Right. We love him, but we understand. Yeah. It makes sense to us.
Yeah. Former Oregon Duck, Chip Kelly. Yeah. Players said that they didn't know if they felt safe being under the watch of the coaching staff, that the coaching staff would have their best interest and their health in mind as they restarted practice. They'd be essentially more concerned about football than about the virus, even as all of this restarted. And so they pushed back on that, and it sounds like they were able to meet with some of the athletic department administrators and reached some kind of a solution that they were satisfied with, and I think things at UCLA have since resumed. But you've also seen just kind of in this moment as – you know, people have felt a little bit more empowered and been speaking out a little bit more, situations where players have spoken up and gotten things done in some ways. Kylan Hill, who is the starting running back for Mississippi State, tweeted a few weeks ago that he wasn't going to be playing unless the state of Mississippi, changed its flag, which includes the imagery of the Confederate battle flag. I don't know if he was the straw that broke the camel's back or if he was the spark that started the fire or if he was just one of the voices that was involved in that. But the Mississippi State Legislature has made the decision that they're moving on from that flag at this point. And Kylan Hill will presumably be playing football for the Bulldogs this fall. There was also a situation, which I think is maybe the most interesting, where Mike Gundy, who's the longtime coach at Oklahoma State, who has drawn some controversy previously for some comments that he said, was seen wearing an OAN, One American News Network shirt, and a photograph, and one of his star players tweeted that he wasn't going to be participating in any Oklahoma State events until some changes happened. And after meeting with Gundy and talking things over, sounds like he was satisfied with the outcome of that. The coach apologized in a video after the player apologized for voicing his concern so publicly, which was kind of another misstep, but again, seems to have been moved in a productive direction. And this morning, Saturday the 4th, as we're recording this, I saw that, and this is what makes this really interesting to me, is that Gundy's salary had been reduced by $1 million and shortened by 1 year his contract after a university review of some of his actions. They said they didn't find any evidence of racism, but felt like he needed to improve his relationships with players in his position as the head football coach, which is something that I've never seen before. Have any coach have his salary reduced and a year chopped off of his contract? I've never seen that in any context in major college football.
Yeah, no, I saw that. It was very interesting to me. I am not someone to sort of cry tears for Mike Gundy, but there are worrisome aspects about it from sort of a, you know, labor rights and employment law aspect, mm-hmm. but that's for another podcast.
I think Gundy in some ways just had not endeared himself right. to the administration by floating his name out there for some other jobs. And he, I think, previously probably maximized his leverage as much as he could to get as much money as he could. And if you wanted to look at this in another context, there are several college football coaches, college basketball coaches, athletic directors who are surrendering 10%, 15%, 25% of their salary to the university this year. Just understanding it's going to be financially a difficult year for most universities. And if you want to look at this in that context, that's kind of what Gundy is doing, just in light of some of these recent actions, that right, almost right. fits a little bit more. But, you know, it's a little bit more permanent than that.
Right, right. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us. This has been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's been a delight to have you. And maybe we can do this again when we know more about what the season is going to happen.
Yeah. One of my interesting things that I kind of hope comes from this is that someone, you know, there's no central decision maker for college football, which is part of what makes some of this so difficult, so many moving parts. But I would like to see some kind of uniformity in reporting for illnesses and injuries come out of this. And we know that Las Vegas would certainly really like that. As we talk about how much money drives things, that's a big part of it as well. So.
Right. Well, to our listeners, thank you so much. We will be back shortly on another topic.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Styles catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.